And over the next four centuries, powerful chiefs made their headquarters at the foot and on top of this hill and in the valley below. They built enclosures, small-sized ones, between the large boulders on the top of the hill. And down in the valley, they built a vast, freestanding stone enclosure, known to archaeologists as the Great Enclosure. This was the residence of the paramount chief of this place. And the site itself became known as Zimbahoy, venerated stones, a Shona expression meaning chief's houses or graves. Whence Zimbabwe, or Great Zimbabwe. So powerful are the nationalistic sentiments aroused by Zimbabwe that it has now become the name of a former British colony, southern Rhodesia. Now, Great Zimbabwe prospered greatly, both as a religious center, a ritual center for rainmaking, and also as a focus of the coastal gold and ivory trade between AD 1100 and 1450. Now, we're not talking about constant caravans going backwards and forwards with the interior. We're talking about occasional expeditions which penetrated from the coastal plain up the escarpment onto the plateau and engaged in barter of glass bead strings, seashells, Chinese porcelain and other baubles, for which they took tusks, gold, and presumably the slaves to carry the ivory on the backs of, because there was no other way of moving it. And between about AD 1100 and 1450, the three centuries before Europeans arrived, Zimbabwe was a great focus of this trade. Zimbabwe's great enclosure was a secluded place with massive stone wall of easily quarried granite, more than 800 feet long and 32 feet high. This was the residence of the chief, who dwelt inside in a large mud and thatched dwelling. As for the enclosures atop the neighboring hill, they were important cult centers for both rainmaking and ancestor worship. This was a wealthy, sacred place. By the 15th century, Zimbabwe was the most prosperous of some 10 cattle chiefdoms that flourished on the plateau. Not that they controlled a great deal of territory, probably at the most about 100 miles across, sufficient land to allow both shifting cultivation and large-scale grazing of sizable cattle herds. Now, cattle require a great deal of water, and they also require a great deal of pasturage. For example, it was once estimated that had the Maasai people of East Africa, who were cattle people living in a relatively small territory at the end of the 19th century, been allowed to continue to expand their herds without the constraints of colonial government or cattle disease, they would have required, by 1960, the whole grazable territory of Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania taken together. So the demands on land were high. But it was successful. At Zimbabwe's height, as many as 18,000 people may have lived in the general vicinity of the site. Now, Zimbabwe's chiefs measured their wealth not only in cattle, but in imported goods, such as Chinese porcelain, glass, seashells, and of course gold and ivory. This is all very well, but they lived in an environment of unpredictable rainfall, endemic cattle diseases, and only moderately fertile soils. One expert has estimated that only about half the soil on the plateau was cultivable for any length of time. So one of the reasons they took up this trade and encouraged it, irregular as it was, may have been as a sort of prudent risk management strategy for chiefs who were accustomed to raise armies and enforce tribute assessments over a wide area. It was another source of wealth, of being able to gain the loyalty of people with gifts. But the risk management strategy failed. in about AD 1500, just as the first foreign caravels explored the East African coast, Zimbabwe was abandoned, and the gravity of political power moved further north toward the Zambezi, where the trade routes were prospering.